Good morning, I'm Frank Connolly. You're listening to Making Waves near FM 90.3 FM. And welcome to this morning's show. We have an interesting lineup. We're going to start with our first guest, who is the Chair O'Donnell Chair of Irish Studies and concurrent Professor of Film and TV in the Notre Dame University in the United States, Breena McDermott. Welcome to this morning's programme.
Thanks very much, Frank.
And you're involved in some quite interesting activities, including a film that's going to be broadcast in UCD on Tuesday night, I believe. And the subject of the film is Mairead Farrell, whom listeners might recall was shot dead in rather controversial circumstances in Gibraltar in 1988.
That's correct, yeah. In fact, on the 6th, the anniversary is coming up on the 6th of March, as it happened. It was very controversial. It was a very controversial event, of course.
Explain the circumstances there, Breena.
Well, I suppose it goes back, Frank, back to the late 70s, actually, when I was a student in Trinity. And at the time, a lot of Northerners came down to college there. And one of them was a young woman from Belfast, and she became my best friend. And we were talking, and she was talking about a friend of hers. One day she was very upset, and she said she had to go home immediately. A friend of hers had been shot dead, and another friend of hers had been arrested. And I was from Wexford, you know, so this was not the usual occurrence with your friend. And this would be the late 1970s. Anyway, that was her friend was Mairead Farrell. And so I had known of Mairead Farrell's name through this kind of personal relationship. And it fascinated me from the beginning because we were the same age. We were roughly from the same kind of background. Her family were shopkeepers. My family were shopkeepers in Wexford. Her mother had been from the south, was from County Leitrim, who had gone north. My father was from the north and had come south, you know. We went to the same nuns, this French order of nuns. They had one school in Belfast, one school in Waterford. And just the parallels were fascinating. The major difference being, I was in university, went on to have an academic career. She was in Armagh Jail and went on to have a brutal death at the hands of the SAS in Gibraltar. So that always stayed with me, you know. And it also happened that at the time I was writing a book about Mairead Farrell. This is before Gibraltar happened. I was commissioned by Attic Press. They were a small feminist publisher at the time. And they commissioned me to write a book about prison conditions. And, of course, the whole prison protest, well, had been something huge, and they wanted something focusing on women in prison.
This was in the late 70s, early 80s, when the hunger strike period.
80s. This would have been about 87. So the 81, 82 hunger strikes, the No Wash protest, all of that. And of course, Mairead Farrell would have been the leader of the women in Armagh Jail through all of that period. She spent 15 years in jail, as it happened. She spent 19 days in hunger strike, the first hunger strike. She led the women when they were on the snow wash.
Why was she in jail, Breena? What was the circumstances that led her to Armagh Jail?
At the age of, she was, I think, 18, 19, as part of the IRA's bombing campaign at the time, commercial bombing campaign, she and two others physically carried a bomb into the Conway Hotel on the outskirts of Belfast, told people to get out, and the hotel was blown to smithereens. As part of this, she was caught actually in situ, and one of the IRA volunteers with her, one of the other guys on the bombing operation with her, was shot dead. His name was Sean McDermott. The other person that was on that bombing mission was Kieran Doherty, who died in hunger strike in the 82. Hunger strike is one of the
1981 hunger strike.
1981 hunger strikes.
And so bring us on, bring the clock.
These three young people, all dead at varying periods over the Troubles.
I see. So you now have, following on from the book, was the book published?
No, what happened was, I was writing this book about Mairead. I've been interviewing her for about a year. I've been up and down to Belfast. I went to see her, I suppose, on a Tuesday. This was in 1988. In fact, February 1988.
She was out of jail at this stage, I presume.
She was out of jail. Yeah. She had given an interview to a very big, very widely covered interview to McGill magazine. Her photograph was on the front page of McGill, which was the main current affairs magazine in Ireland at the time.
I used to work for it at the time, actually, yeah.
Remember that? And there was Jenny McGeever, who was an RT at the time, interviewed Mairead at length. So I contacted her. She said yes, she would do the book with me. So I spent a year and a half, going up to Belfast every week, interviewing her on audio tape. Came back home, rang her the next week. Her mother answered the phone and said, yes, Mairead told me to tell you she had to go away for a couple of days. Mm-hmm. The next day, I walked out of my front door, and there was her face on the front of the tabloids. She'd been one of the people shot dead by the SAS in Gibraltar.
She was on active service with the IRA in Gibraltar.
And it was unbelievable. I mean, I knew, because I'd been interviewing her, that she had not changed her views in any way. She was a totally committed Republican, totally committed to what she saw as the necessity for armed struggle. But I never thought, to be honest with you, that she would have gone back into the IRA on active service in that way. Mainly because her face had been all over the papers. And I know she'd started back in Queens. So the shock was unbelievable, to be honest with you. And I sort of finished the book and then didn't, because then it was a very different kind of book.
Sure.
And the material was really raw, you know. I really, really like Mairead as a person. The troubles were at its height. Their deaths in Gibraltar, of course, led then to the deaths in Middletown Cemetery.
Well, let's go back to that, because that was a particularly controversial few weeks, and brutal few weeks. The bodies of the three were brought back from Gibraltar to Dublin, if I recall.
They were eventually, yeah. And indeed, most of the commercial airliners refused to bring the bodies back home. And I think the families and Sinn Féin, on their behalf, had to hire a special plane to bring the bodies, a freight plane, to bring the bodies into Dublin Airport. There was huge security presence at the border. It was really
the cortege went from Dublin to Belfast. Yeah,
they went up to Belfast. RUC took the bodies back off, and the day of the funeral, everybody was in Middletown Cemetery when there was an unprecedented attack by Oliver Stone, a loyalist, with a revolver and grenades on the mourners and on the funeral.
As it turned out, I was also in the Middletown Cemetery
that day.
Yeah, and in fact joined a crowd of incredibly courageous young people who chased after Michael Stone, who was still firing shots and throwing grenades at them. And
I mean, to see that actually was quite extraordinary. These were unarmed people running after a man who was shooting at them and throwing grenades at them. And I have to say, I was not running after Michael Stone. I was hiding behind a gravestone.
Mm.
And, you know, watching people pass by with their faces bloodied, with their coats. I remember one woman I knew, actually, who was from Dublin. And she was carried out, and she had a white kind of a raincoat on, and she was totally covered in blood. I mean, it was a terrifying and unprecedented attack, I have to say. And, of course, three people lost their lives.
I picked up one of them, Thomas McAleen, I think, was the young man's name. And, of course, one was also an IRA member, Brady O'Brady.
Yeah.
And, of course, that followed then during the funerals of those three men, or of one of those, there was the incursion by two plainclothes British soldiers who were subsequently shot dead.
Killed, and again, that whole week, to be honest, looking back on the fact, and of course, because making this documentary, I had to go back and be like, some of these things people don't want to think about. Maybe you push them out of your memory because they're so traumatic, you know.
And tell us about the documentary.
And I was on the fringes of it. So,
yeah.
But having to go back and remember that, and that I really remember it as probably the darkest period in my whole life. Certainly, the darkest period that I remember in Irish history.
It certainly was an extraordinary week. And Alex Reid,
I think people felt, interestingly, that I remember one woman saying in the graveyard, you know, if they want Beirut, we'll give them Beirut. But there was also a sense that if we have to be careful here because we could go over the brink. I mean, things were bad enough, but I do think people saw how it could go, that it could go even more horrific than things had been.
Sure. And, of course, Alex Reid was the priest who was on the spot and gave the last rites to the two soldiers.
And that dreadful image, I mean, you know, beamed all over the world, actually.
Tell us about the documentary then. What? Tell us how long is it? What does it cover?
It's been a long time in the making. It's, I suppose, because of the book, I really didn't want to do the book. I felt stuff was too raw, you know. And I left it there. So then I became a documentary maker over the years. And I had been kind of developing this as a documentary. And again, I went, then I got a job in America, went to America, left it to one side. And then I was approached by Martina Jurak and Vanessa Gilday from Loopline Films, who had made a series called The Non IRA for TG Cahir. And they were interested in doing something more aid on TG Cahir, put them in my direction because I had been developing that with them in the film board. So we decided to work together. And it's an interesting documentary, I think, because it's not a straightforward chronological biography of Mairead Farrell.
Mm-hmm.
It's more really, I suppose, it's an attempt to contextualise her, I suppose, through memory, you know.
And are you using the tapes? Are you using the tapes that you did with her? Yeah,
we use some of the tapes. Of course, we're 52 minutes, so it's hard to do everything.
Sure.
And, you know, it's not an investigation. It's not an investigative current affairs approach. It's really looking back and seeing, you know, through my memories, going to meet people who knew her, trying to, like, what motivated Mairead? Do you know, what made someone, I mean, at the time, the British called her, I remember this particular politician calling her a mass murderer, you know, the English tabloids coming out saying scum. And then, of course, her own people in Belfast, for them she was a hero, a martyr who had given her life for the things she believed in and for her community. So you have, so really what you think about Mairead Farrell depends very much, I think, on your perspective and where you come from.
I'm talking to Breena McDermott, who is the Notre Dame O'Donnell Chair of Irish Studies and concurrent Professor of Film and TV. And her documentary on Mairead Farrell, the IRA volunteer who was killed in Gibraltar in 1988, along with two of her comrades, is the subject of a documentary by Breena, which is showing in UCD on Tuesday night. Breena, if there are tickets available for this showing, how do people contact the organisers?
Well, it's, I think, through Ursula Barry, who's the chair of Women's Studies in UCD. As far as I know, it's quite a small cinema, and I think the tickets might be gone. But I just want to emphasise this is a preview, Frank.
Yes.
And it will have a further airing on TG Cahir, national broadcast on TG Cahir, sometime toward the end of the summer, I think, or early autumn.
Very good. We've spoken about Mairead Farrell. Just before we go, what cooperation did you get from her family and her friends in the making of the documentary? And do they feature?
Again, something like this, you're dealing with people's emotions, you're dealing with people with flesh and blood, people who have families. And particularly in this instance, the amount of hurt. So we were very conscious in the beginning that we did not want to in any way make the pain of the families or friends any worse. So in terms of Mairead's family, we did speak to one of her brothers who was very helpful. The rest of the family felt that they would prefer not to get themselves involved in it. And we had very good cooperation from her friends. So I spoke to like a number of people, everybody in the documentary, because of the style of it, knew Mairead or at least was part of. For example, we talked to Geoffrey Howe and Tom King.
Right.
Because quite obviously they had a big input into the events at Gibraltar. So everybody that we spoke with, you know, was they were not tangential in any way to the story. They were central. As I say, we spoke to two of her friends and comrades who had been in jail with her, Mary Doyle, who had been on hunger strike with her, and Sinead Moore, who was, I suppose, her cellmate and best friend for all those years.
And tell us, you mentioned Geoffrey Howe and Tom King, both of whom were members of the British government at the time. Of course, the suspicion was that this... The British Secret Service, I suppose, MI5 or MI6, had tracked the three to Gibraltar, knew that they were planning some sort of an attack on British troops on the island, and shot them in cold blood. At least that is according to an eyewitness. Tell us about that.
And we spoke to those eyewitnesses. We went over and I spoke with Stephen Bullock, who saw, he saw the death of Sean Savage. And his description of what happened, at least of what he saw on the day, does not in any way tally with the official report of the SAS, but it does tally much more closely with the coroner's report and the forensics. And we also spoke with Carmen Proetta. I don't know if people remember Carmen.
I remember Carmen Proetta.
Carmen
Proetta, yeah, yeah.
But she came out and she said she saw Mairead Farrell and Dan McCann being shot at close range by armed men. And she completely disputed the official version of events.
Which was?
And as a result of that, Carmen Proetta, I mean, she was, talk about trial by tabloid, she was called the prostitute of Gibraltar.
That's right.
Very, very unpleasant names. In fact, Carmen Proetta has moved to Spain. She felt unable to continue to live in Gibraltar. And it was very interesting going to see her, because here's a woman who told the truth as she saw it on the day. And her life, her life indeed, was never the same after that.
That's an extraordinary story. And without revealing any secrets in the of the documentary, how did the two British ministers react when you asked them about how to justify this?
That's very interesting. Again, we've obviously only been able to use a portion of both of the interviews. But what was quite interesting was that they don't seem to have any regret. And that was the question I asked them directly, you know,
yeah.
That there was no regret, that things, I mean, that they felt that they were entirely justified in what they did. And absolutely no regrets.
Extraordinary.
That did surprise me, I have to say.
Especially as we've had a peace process and a bedding in
well,
of that since
then.
Well,
that's the point. I mean, I think when I spoke to Republicans, you can see people have, softened is not the word, but people have begun to be more generous, I suppose, in their interpretations of the past and a bit more open. And I have to say, personally, that was one of the things that, well, did surprise me and also disappointed me, that there didn't seem to be that same largesse of generosity of spirit. Certainly on the part of both of the ministers. Although they did speak to us, which again, I suppose, also surprised me somewhat that they were prepared to give interviews about this particular incident.
I suppose
incident.
That's something. And the name of the film?
The name of the film is called Mairead Farrell, An Unfinished Conversation, or for the Irish version, Corrog on Creagh.
And as you say, it's showing later in the summer on TG Cahir.
It'll be shown later in the summer on TG Cahir, and a preview, as I say, on Tuesday.
Okay, Breena, before we go, I just want to talk briefly about some of your other projects that are coming up over the coming years, including one we've spoken about on this programme quite a lot, which is the run into the commemoration of 1916. Last year we had, of course, the lockout centenary celebrations.
Of course, yes, indeed, you're very involved in there, Frank, obviously. With
yeah, and SIPTU and the Congress of Trade Unions had a big input into those commemorations, obviously. But also we'll have in the 1916 commemorations, because, of course, James Connolly led the Irish Citizen Army on Easter Monday 1916 from Liberty Hall around to the GPO, and the rest, as they say, is history. But you're doing a film project on that theme also.
That's correct. We're doing, when I say we here, I'm talking specifically about the Keonathan Institute at the University of Notre Dame, have initiated a very large, very ambitious project to do a three-part television history of 1916.
Mm-hmm.
We have RTE are committed to showing it here, PBS, Coast to Coast of the States.
That's public broadcaster, yeah?
Yeah, we've been it's the public service broadcaster. So we've been developing this for maybe 2 years. We have done a lot of research. We've had a researcher in the National Library cataloguing previously uncatalogued material. Because it's a university, we've been able to do this. The funding is coming from donors to the university. So it's the intellectual ambition and scope of this is really, really high.
Mm.
And it really is to bring serious history to a vast audience.
And are you having actors? Is it drama?
Or? No, it's not. It will be using a lot of archive, a lot of stills, images. We will have certain things will be reimagined, but not necessarily through reconstruction. In fact, Alan Gilsonen who's an award-winning director, probably one of the best-known documentary directors in the country, will direct it. We have Coco Television producing here. We've got Siskel Jacobs, a really well-known production company in the States, have won 2 Emmys in this kind of historical documentary, as are American producers. So it's a very exciting project, Frank. And really, it's what inspired me to do this was the idea that if you were to move back a little bit, because we're constantly looking at ourselves in this, you know, in Ireland, this kind of insular way, and looking inward, you know, was to because 1916 was a huge event in world politics. And sometimes when we just simply focus in on that, on the Irish aspects of it, and Irish exceptionalism, we misread it, you know?
Absolutely, yeah.
And as Pierce said himself, I mean, 1916 would not have happened without specifically Irish America. So really what we're trying to do with this, I suppose, is put it in its global perspective.
Very good. And Liam Neeson, I believe...
And Liam Neeson has also... We also have Liam Neeson contracted, and he's going to do the narration.
OK, listen, Breena, that has been quite an amazing conversation this morning, and I appreciate coming on the line. You're all the way from Tipperary.
You're welcome.
And hopefully you'll come back and we can talk about these and other matters, and leading up, of course, to 1916. This is Breena McDermott.
Indeed, I'd love to.
Thanks very much again, Breena. And you're listening to Making Waves. I'm Frank Connolly, and we're here every Sunday between 12 and 1 o'clock. Text number 0876944500. On the line now is another interesting man who is also our current Mayor of Dublin, Oisin Quinn. Welcome to Making Waves.
Good afternoon, Frank. Thank you very much for having me on.
And thanks for taking the call. There are a couple of things I'd like to talk to you about. I know you're under pressure. You're running from one function to another. And your comments recently about the St. Paddy's Day parade and the events surrounding it, you attracted a little bit of criticism for some of your views expressed, particularly on the Funderland aspect of the Paddy's Day.
That's right. Well, it certainly generated a debate, which, to be honest with you, I was happy about, because I feel we need to look again at the festival. It's an amazing opportunity to showcase Dublin and also to put on a festival that Dubliners can really enjoy, but something that's different from what normally happens in the city. And I was keen to generate that debate, and I raised issues with the organisers of the festival, and I think, you know, hopefully we will see in the future a better working relationship between the festival and the city council, and also, I think, in actual fact, a refreshing of the festival. To put it in context, we celebrate the Chinese New Year Festival in Dublin with a two-week festival. It's Europe's biggest Chinese New Year festival. We celebrate the Russian Festival of Spring with a one-week festival for the Russian community in Dublin. And obviously China and Russia are important countries from the point of view of the city, and we have big Chinese and Russian communities. But the St. Patrick's Day Festival, believe it or not, is a four-day festival. So it's smaller than those two. And my concern, or one of my concerns, was around the large fun fair that dominates Merrion Square over the weekend and leads to a lot of drinking. And it has nothing really to do with Dublin's culture or history. And I felt and feel we could do something much more ambitious and showcase upcoming bands and musicians, local food producers, art and theatre. Local community festivals through the year could have a chance to showcase their best work in this festival.
And that's an open-air market type of thing.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, exactly. To bring the festival in that sense and its cultural traditions right out onto the streets for Dubliners. That's not to say that there aren't good events happening. And I have, pushed those and very keen to, you know, recommend those to Dubliners to get involved and to enjoy it. So from my point of view, I just felt it could be more ambitious given
but,
the opportunity okay. we have. And,
Oisin, yeah. just let me interrupt you. Sorry for interrupting you. The point, though, many listeners might wonder is you're the Lord Mayor. The organisers, when they heard your criticism of the funfair aspect, were quite defensive. I heard them on radio myself. Does the Lord Mayor perhaps not have more of an influence in determining the nature of the event, or is there a separation between your office and the organisation?
Well, there has been a separation, but I've met since with David Harvey, the outgoing chairman, and we've agreed we will find a way to work closer, and I've spoken to the minister, Liam Radker, who will be appointing a new chairman, and I've kept him updated about my thoughts on it. But you're right, in actual fact, there is a very unusual arrangement where there is a festival committee that really aren't accountable to anyone as such, and there is a chief executive and staff that just report to this festival committee. And we have tried in recent years on Dublin City Council to have a councillor appointed to the committee. There is an official who sits on it, but those efforts have been rebuffed, and we've made suggestions in the past about various different things, like finding a way to commemorate the 1913 lockout in last year's parade, and that was unsuccessful.
That's right, I remember that.
The Festival Committee as such is a sort of an unusual organisation in that while the Minister appoints the chairperson, the other people are on the committee by stint have been appointed by various organisations. And I think certainly the way in which it works could become more transparent and it could be more inclusive and so on. And I certainly found, I initially raised my concerns of what's called an events committee, but I suppose just to explain to your listeners, neither Dublin City Council nor I as Lord Mayor or the Lord Mayor's office really have any say over how the festival operates. I raised my concerns at the events committee, which was an internal meeting, and those concerns were fairly strongly rebuffed, unfortunately.
Okay. I'd like to ask you, it leads into the second area I wanted to discuss with you, and that's the idea of a directly elected Lord Mayor. Of course, if you were the directly elected Lord Mayor, these guys would all do what they're told about the Paddy's Day Parade, wouldn't they?
Well, one of the proposals as part of the directly elected Mayor is to give the Mayor's office a strong role in promoting the city from a tourist point of view. I mean, I'm convinced there is huge potential to promote Dublin as a standalone tourist destination. And at the moment, we don't have a strong way of doing that. Fáil to Ireland have a responsibility for promoting the country, but that's very much a different product in a way from a city. There is a very distinctive tourism product for cities. I mean, there will be people all around Europe and indeed in Dublin thinking about city breaks, and we've got great cheap airline access now, and Dublin is a great city to come to, and it does need a strong voice to promote it. So to give you an example, between 2007 and 2012, tourism in Dublin was completely flat. And you know, one can say, well, the world economy was struggling. But at the same time, Copenhagen, which has a different model, its worst year of growth was 8% during that five-year period. Mm. And I'm kind of convinced we can do a lot better in terms of promoting the city if we had a strong voice for Dublin tasked with doing it. And to put things in context, when there was a Dublin Tourism Office, Dublin City Council's budget and contribution to it was €750,000. At the same time, Fáil to Ireland, whose job is to sell the country from a tourist point of view, have a budget of €140 million. So the scale is huge, and we are missing an opportunity, in my view, by not promoting Dublin.
But this is slightly separate, though, from the arguments for having a directly elected mayor. It's not just about tourism. It's actually about the running of the city.
Oh, you're right. I mean, there's a much bigger argument, really, about looking at changing the system. I mean, your listeners will know at the moment or will say, well, the Lord Mayor, how is the Lord Mayor elected? There isn't a direct connection between the Lord Mayor and the entire population of Dublin. The Lord Mayor is elected by the City Council every year, and the City Council are elected by Dubliners every 5 years. But you're right, the argument for a directly elected mayor is a much bigger one. And you're there into, you know, giving Dubliners a real say in shaping the debate about the future of the city and a real connection between the people running the city and Dubliners. And you're right, it's a lot bigger than just the tourism example.
And what are the chances of it happening, Oisin?
Well, it's interesting as to where the process is at the moment. So last year, I had to convene a forum of councillors from the four Dublin local authorities. So that would include Fingal and South County Dublin and Dunleary Rathdown. And we looked at international examples, and we carried out a good public consultation process. And we had a number of meetings and debates about the type of directly elected mayor model that might work for Dublin. And we made a recommendation at the end of December to the minister for a strong executive mayor for a five-year term directly elected with a strong role in transport and tourism and economic development and the other areas that local government currently does, but does it over four local authorities. And that report is with the minister, and the process under the Local Government Act 2014 gives the minister the chance to change that proposal if he so wishes, and then to send it back to the four councils in March for the councils to decide if they want to let Dubliners vote on it.
So this is Leo Varadkar is the relevant minister.
No, it's Phil Hogan.
Phil Hogan, Department of the Environment,
yeah.
Okay.
And
there must be resistance, though, of course, from councillors who for many, many years, decades indeed, have their own, you know, little power centres in various parts of the city. They don't like ceding powers, I'd imagine, to a powerful new mayor.
Well, the main transfer of power that would occur here would be from central government to the new office of directly elected mayor. But you're right to identify that there were some councillors on the forum from some of the other local authorities who were concerned as to whether or not this would undermine their own council. So, for example, sure. Fingal has a mayor, and that mayor can travel to cities that Fingal is twinned with and so on. And there were some concerns, there's no doubt about that. But on the other hand, a lot of councillors on the forum felt that the creation of this office would give councillors an enhanced role to hold the directly elected mayor and his or her candidate to account in a public and transparent way. And we built in a lot of powers by making the office of directly elected mayor and his or her candidate accountable publicly once a month to a Dublin Assembly of councillors, who would also vet the appointments to the cabinet and would have to approve the budget on an annual basis and would have a two-thirds impeachment power as well. So we very much have proposed a model that would require whoever might be elected as the directly elected mayor to work with councillors on an ongoing basis and effectively pull them back to the centre and give councillors a strong role in ensuring that whatever mandate the directly elected mayor secured, that they would be held to that in a public way. So I very much see here an enhanced role for councillors who have an interest in strategic issues concerning the city. But we also had another proposal, which, if you like, is the second half of a double devolution, so devolution of power from central government to the mayor's office, but then also a strong provision in the proposal for a devolution of power down to area committees, so that councillors who are interested in working in their local urban villages, and that can be Ranelagh, it can be Swords, it can be Tallaght, and these are big urban spaces in ways, can spend a lot of time really dealing with the officials who are involved there. So if you want to come up with proposals for Herbert Park or the parking arrangements in Ranelagh, whatever local issues councillors are naturally interested in because their constituents are interested in, we're proposing something that will give them a strong role as well. So I certainly see councillors' roles being enhanced in this proposal, but that's not to say that this proposal for change brought about some concerns. But in the end, on the forum,
all of
the councillors, bar one, were supportive of the proposal.
And when, if ever, is this likely to take place? And will it involve four directly elected mayors or one mayor for the four different councils?
No, it's a proposal that there would only be one mayor for the Dublin county region, and then there would just be chairs of the four local authorities. So Dublin would just have one mayor, and we felt really that the city was of a scale where it just justified having one mayor. So I would hope that this month, and Dublin City Council's meeting will take place on the 24th of March, we will vote in favour of giving Dubliners a chance to have their vote. The idea is to hold a plebiscite in May, on the 23rd of May, the same day as the local and European elections, where Dubliners, as well as voting for the European elections and as well as voting in the local elections, will also have a ballot paper asking them, are they in favour of Dublin moving to a directly elected mayor system? And there'll be details of that proposal available.
So that's is actually a plebiscite taking place then on the 23rd of
May? Well, for the plebiscite to take place, the Act requires all four local authorities separately to vote in favour of allowing the plebiscite.
Okay.
It's a slightly unusual lock in a way, and it's something I'm a tiny bit concerned about, because it does mean a small number of councillors could block Dubliners having their say.
And that, as they say, that's another day's work. But perhaps we'll get you back, Oisin. I know you're under pressure for time, and so are we. I'd like to thank you a lot for coming on air this morning. That's a very interesting discussion, and we will ask you perhaps closer to the date of that plebiscite to give us your update on what's happening with regard to the directly elected mayor idea. Thanks very much, Lord Mayor.
Thank you very much, Frank. Delighted to be on. Thank you.
Thank you.